Call the meeting to order. First thing we have on today's schedule is House File 1992, Representative Dean. Welcome back to the committee again.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Looks like we're lacking a quorum, so we'll go ahead and let you start presenting your bill, and then we'll come back and make the motion to move it. And it will be going to Human Health and Human Services Policy, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Dean.
Madam Chair and members, before we go into the bill and start discussion and testimony, I'm curious about where we ended up settling on the delete all amendment, as far as if we met the 24-hour rule or if we didn't meet the rule. So I wonder if Committee Administrator Mr. Amare could give us some information on that.
Right. It's a little complex. So everybody, please listen up here. Thank you.
So the rule, as it has been practiced, has been to submit bills by noon the day before, and then to post as practicable. As I said before, that typically has tried to give me a 30-minute window to try and get them posted from when I receive them. Everyone should have seen the DE1 amendment, which was posted a couple days ago. Their subsequent amendments came, and they came, and there was a DE3 amendment, which was received in my email box at 12:05. And so I said to the advocates and others, I said, that is not conforming with the 24-hour rule as it has been practiced. However, they would like this to be the proposal that is discussed. So I recommended to the chair that she take it up with the full committee, and if they are willing to go along with that, then they could. So that is kind of where we stand. The intent of the author, or at least the advocates who have been working with the author, has to have the D3 amendment be considered, not the DE1 amendment that was posted. And so what we're going to do, so for some people this is new, and so what we're actually going to have them do is explain the differences between the DE1 amendment and a DE3 amendment. There is only one substantive amendment, or one substantive change between the DE1 amendment and the DE3 amendment. And the advocates and Representative Dean will explain that one difference, just so everyone understands. And I'm trying to be fair, because I understand it did not meet the 24-hour rule. So I'd like to just first take a chance to go through those differences and then hand it over to the chair. So
no, let me just say, the only way we would consider that amendment then is unanimous consent of the body. So if people we can talk about it today, but in order to act on it, I would want unanimous consent of the members. So just we'll consider that later. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Having just receive the amendment, we certainly could talk about it, but I would not feel comfortable voting on it today.
That's fine. Let's go through the conversation, and if that changes when we get to the end of it, then we'll do it. Otherwise, we'll bring back the bill back another time and look at it too. We can do it either way. I just want to go along with the rules here, make sure that everybody's comfortable with it. So we do now have a quorum, so we can have a motion. Representative Isaacson moves House File 1992 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services. Policy Committee, okay. And you do have the DE1 amendment. We should probably put that one on and then change it, or do you want to, how would you like to do that, Representative Dean? I'm not sure that I've heard a little bit about the differences. Mm-hmm. Does it help you to have DE1 on first? Or do you want to have your witness?
Madam Chair, I have actually Ethan Roberts here to can go through and explain what these changes are. Right now you're getting passed out what are the differences between the DE1 and the DE3. So if it would help the committee, if we could just go through this, and then we can have a conversation. Do we move forward with the discussion around the DE1, or do we just move forward with the DE3?
Let's get those out to everybody before we have that conversation. Well, all Okay, I'll just note, all the Republicans have it, none of the Democrats do, so that's fine. We can start. thank you. Our staff will go make some more copies for the members. Why don't you go ahead and why don't you explain your bill, first of all, what it is, and then we'll talk about the amendments, and maybe we'll have, by the time we get to that, we'll have copies.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. So I'm going to give you a quick, brief outline of the bill. The issue is home and community-based settings for people with disabilities. We currently have in statute a rule that is no more than the greater of 4 or 25% of the units in a multifamily building of more than 4 units, unless required by housing opportunities for persons with AIDS. We have a limit. As far as that goes, that's what we have in place. And what the bill does is it puts in place a process by which we can have exceptions to that 25% rule. And the reason that I brought this bill forward is there are populations that the 25% rule does cause some, complications in how they live day to day and how they function, as well as, you know, this will allow those communities that would like to have a choice to have that opportunity to have the choice. But the setting for the owner of the setting would still have to go through a process of approval for that exception. And I mean, I can't get in all of the weeds, but I mean, there's lots of complications with this regarding, you know, certain types of thing around CMS rules. There have been ongoing discussions from both sides of the advocates to get to the bill that we've got to today. And I know that DHS is here if folks have specific questions that I may not be able to answer. Okay. But first I'd like to turn it over to Ethan Roberts so that he can go through what the changes are. And then it'd be great if we could make the decision whether we go with the DE1 or the DE3 today.
Okay, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Roberts. And you're going to go over the differences between the bill and what would be in the DE3 amendment. Is that correct?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go over the differences between the DE1 amendment, which was posted online on Monday, and the DE3 amendment, which was initially sent by House Research to the committee chair shortly before noon. Unfortunately, it didn't have an attachment, and then was sent to 1206 with the attachment. But I do apologize, though, that we even came that close to 1230. And not to offer excuses, but I think it's important that everyone on the committee understand that this bill is the product of months and months of conversations, of negotiations between all of the stakeholders that we think are irrelevant. And in the process of managing a 25-member coalition, which I am the representative of for the Coalition for Choice in Housing, and working with at least 5 other stakeholders, people kept having better ideas. Okay. And so we kept, maybe we let the perfect become the enemy of the good in this case, because honestly, the difference between the DE1 and the DE3, in our opinion, is not substantive. And so if the committee feels as though you want to take a vote just on the DE1 as presented, it will be okay. We can move forward and we can make those adjustments. We were hoping, however, we could move the DE3 because it reflects exactly where we all are at in terms of the advocates today. And we also make some changes. For example, DE1, if you look at the handout, line 4.9, change year to 2015, we literally had, say, we had a requirement the department would convene a group by January 1st, 2014. Well, obviously that's not practical. That's already passed. We have a reference to NAMI, but we don't have NAMI Minnesota. So a lot of these changes are really just very technical. In terms of perhaps arguably substantive, we did think it was important that this not be an open-ended process. And so the first change inserted in line 2.13, here I am referring to the DE3, which I know that you have in your packets, says that we would like the commissioner to begin to accept the applications for this exceptions process, which we haven't even explained to you yet, so I really do feel badly for you because I think we're really starting in the middle of the story, by January 1st, 2015, which we believe gives the department adequate time to kind of work out the process. And there are other reasons which we'll get to later. Line 2.16, at the discretion of the organization, that we're taking out and then we're inserting it basically someplace else a little bit below in line 4.6. So it's just sort of a reordering of the same idea. Additionally, line 2.16, there was a question, well, what does a setting mean? And we made it clear that it's an owner, operator, developer of a setting. So again, we feel that DE3 is just a better version of this bill than DE1, but either would work. And we don't feel as though we can move forward if that's what the committee wants on DE1. I think those are the changes. They really, in our opinion, and I'm trying to be, you know, completely candid, we believe these are just technical changes which improve upon the bill. It was initially submitted at 11:54 without the attachment, 12:06 with the attachment. In our understanding, that was in the 24 hours in advance. But we very much apologize for that. For members, this is the first time you're seeing it. And so, irrespective of when we sent it in, from your perspective, it's the first time you're seeing it, and I understand that could be difficult. So we accept the judgment of the committee either way.
Member Simpson?
Well, Madam Chair, I would just ask if there are any questions from the members.
Okay. Questions from committee members?
Of the changes between DE1 and DE3.
Or the bill itself,
to understand. We can absolutely get to the bill as well.
Madam Chair, Sean Burke from the Disability Law Center, who represented, I wouldn't say the other side, it's been very collaborative, but the other stakeholders who had issues initially with a full repeal, we are prepared to go through either version of the bill shortly. Again, I do apologize, but I talk about these changes. We really are starting in the middle of a story.
You know what I think might be helpful is to actually hear from the witnesses so people really understand what's at stake here. That's what I would advise to the author.
I think that makes sense.
Okay. So let's go ahead and hear the witnesses. Representative Anderson.
Chuck. Madam Chair, a question for you. If we acted on the D1 amendment today, couldn't the D3 be introduced at the next committee?
Yes, it could. That is another alternative. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd like to bring up Chuck Peterson with Clare House.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak today. As you heard, I'm Chuck Peterson. I serve as the Executive Director of Clare Housing and also Chairperson of the Coalition for Choice in Housing. And we are a diverse and growing coalition of tenants and advocates and individuals and providers who share a fundamental belief that all people, including people with disabilities, should have a meaningful choice in quality housing. Our membership includes over 20-some organizations, including organizations like Accessible Space, Jewish Housing and Programming, Project for Pride and Living, and RS Eden as well. And as a coalition, we all provide affordable housing and supportive services to thousands of individuals in Minnesota each year. Collectively, we're reducing homelessness, we're improving health outcomes in our state, we're building strong communities, and we're providing a safe and stable home for people who are living with a disability. Through our housing programs, many of our clients and residents benefit from waived services. So we're here today to seek your support of House File 1992, which will correct a well-intentioned Minnesota statute, 256B.492, which establishes a no more than 25% statutory limitation on the number of people on waived services that can reside in a single congregate living environment, and which denies people with disabilities the government-funded home and community-based services that they are entitled to and require. Our goal in this session is not to replace the present statutory limitation with nothing. As Ethan said, over the last several months, we've been working very closely with community stakeholders, including organizations like NAMI, ARC, the Mental Health Association, and Disability Law Center, to revise the current statute with language that considers the totality of an individual's experience while maximizing opportunities for community integration, promoting innovation, and ensuring meaningful choice. We seek to find a solution that allows for the continuation of successful supportive housing environments like Clare Housing and prevents us from backsliding to the days of institutionalization and inadequate substandard housing and care. As you know, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services recently issued the Medicaid Home and Community-Based Service Settings Final Rule. In this rule, this addresses the requirements for all home and community-based settings. These standards require meaningful qualifications such as access to the greater community, autonomy, privacy, and most importantly, choice be present in all settings. Notably, arbitrary limitations, including a blanket ban on disability-specific complexes, were considered but were rejected by the federal rule. Passing HF 1992 and granting an exception process is consistent with the CMS ruling. We believe the time to act on the ruling is now, and people we serve are at risk of losing their housing and services if the current statutory limitation is enforced. Government funding is at risk, and in some cases being denied or even delayed. We hope that during this session we can pass a thoughtful revision so that all Minnesotans have a meaningful choice in quality housing that meets their individual preferences and needs. So at this point, I'd like to turn to Ben Ashley Wertman, who is going to share his perspective on this issue from the Mental Health Association. Following Ben's comments, we'll invite Ethan and Sean to answer any questions you may have specifically about the bill. And then we'd like for you to hear from Zachary Johnson, who will share with you his personal story as to why passing this legislation is important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions for committee members?
Madam Chair. So we've got a little bit of a list of testifiers.
We do.
And do you also have testifiers who are perhaps opposed to this?
I'm not sure. We're going to certainly invite anybody from the audience who wants to testify against it.
All right.
Actually, I don't think anybody notified us of that, do we?
Everyone.
Yeah, everyone who asked is on the list, but we'll see. Especially okay. If you know of someone, that would be fine.
No, I don't have anybody in my back pocket.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Any comments or questions otherwise for Mr. Peterson? All right. Ben Ashley, are you the next person?
Yep. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Ashley Wertman. I represent the Mental Health Association of Minnesota, and this spring we're celebrating 75 years of being a guiding light for Minnesotans living with mental illnesses. I am actually probably as close as we'll come today to an opposition, but a very loyal one, as it turns out, in cooperation with ARC of Minnesota, NAMI Minnesota, the Disability Law Center, and the Coalition for Choice in Housing. We've come up with a compromise position that we all really truly believe in. I thank them for their sincerity in coming to the table, the hard work that they've done with us. I think we can all be proud of the result. So since November, we've been having these conversations about the repeal or revision of the 25% rule. The first proposal was a straight repeal, that the limit would simply come off the books. We had two very serious concerns. The first is that the 25% limit is a valuable, if very blunt, tool for trying to move Minnesota towards more independent, more scattered site housing. The trajectory for all housing and services for people with disabilities is towards more independence and more scattered sites, more connection with the community. That trajectory is clearly being charted in the HUD 811 housing program. You may know that until 2011, they were supporting 100% disability-specific projects. Since that time, they're now moving towards scattered site projects. 95 units are here in Minnesota, and they, in fact, use a similar limitation. No more than 25% of the units in a specific building can have a disability preference. Under those new CMS regulations that we've discussed, Minnesota will be required to submit a complete plan to CMS about how we're going to meet our obligations for quality and for making sure that people have real, genuine opportunities to choose scattered site housing if that's their preference. Olmstead, CMS, all of these movements are pushing us towards offering a range of options. So we have this obligation to provide meaningful choice. I'm sure you are all aware that housing dollars are scarce. When we fund projects, we must choose projects that will meet needs for years to come, be a wise investment, and continue to be reimbursable if they are designed to do so. There's significant work that needs to be done to plan those CMS, the response to CMS regulations. Our first plan is due in 2015. That is a very short timeline. We understand the urgency, and we do agree with the coalition on that matter, but we strongly believe that a wholesale repeal could jeopardize Minnesota's ability to respond effectively and implement these requirements. The second major concern that we had was with oversight and quality. Poor housing for people with disabilities is a recent memory, especially in the mental health community. We remember that social isolation and a lack of housing options can make people vulnerable to simply accepting whatever they can get, even if it is deficient and unsafe for them. We believe that sunshine disinfects. For this, it means people who aren't residents, who aren't paid staff, entering the building on a regular basis, seeing what's going on, and being willing to speak up if something is a problem. The 25% policy did help make that happen. Replacing that organic oversight with something else requires a thoughtful policy, and that's where the exemptions process comes in. We believe that by contrast to a straight repeal, it will more closely integrate higher density settings into a range of housing options. Providers will be incentivized to show support for transition, housing choice. We know from our conversations that they have a variety of different skills, a variety of different roles within the housing community. Whatever their contribution is, that will be rewarded if it helps build a better housing system for Minnesota. It holds providers to quality standards, but ones that make sense for the populations they serve. The providers we were speaking to, they're striving to make best practices, not make bare bones minimums. And we want that rewarded. We want those to be the people who are serving Minnesotans with disabilities. But we need DHS to have the authority to turn away the few bad apples that may try to enter the market. We also believe that the exceptions ensure that advocates and residents have an opportunity to publicly comment on proposed projects. The scope, the nature of the exemption will be discussed. The demand for that project will be considered. These settings are part of a broad spectrum, as I mentioned. We do not want them underbuilt. We do not want them overbuilt. I've seen my options. This is what I want. That's a great reason to choose a housing setting. This is the only thing that was offered to me. It's the only thing I can afford. That's a very poor reason to choose a housing setting. So a thoughtful exemptions process means a smarter, sharper tool that helps create the right spectrum of housing options and meets goals for quality and integration. I truly look forward to the stakeholder meetings that we have planned to finalize the details of the application process. Over these conversations, we have built a significant amount of trust. I believe we all believe that this process will be fair to housing providers, it will be responsive to the residents who want to choose these settings, and it will balance our needs for protection standards and movement towards scattered site housing. On behalf of Mental Health Association Minnesota, NAMI Minnesota, the ARC of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Disability Law Center, I would ask that the committee consider the exemption process in this amendment to be the preferred solution for the issues surrounding the 25% concentration limit.
Thank you, Mr. Ashley Wertman. So can I just clarify, the D3 amendment contains the language that you approve then? Is that you've come to an agreement
yes.
with?
Yes. The D3 is the best available version. The D1 is simply a slightly earlier draft within okay. the process. It's, you know, 90-95% of the way there. The D3 is the last few tweaks that we added.
All right. Thank you. And congratulations on 75 years, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. To the testifier, give me some background here. Reasoning why the 25% rule was put into effect in the first place, and is the problem a lack of housing, and what will this repealer and the exemption do in terms of making more and better housing available? That's what we all want.
Mm-hmm. Ashley Wertman.
Absolutely. Part of the original consideration with the 25% cap was funding issues. Another concern was promoting scattered site housing. And as I mentioned, it's a tool for promoting that scattered site housing. It just happens to be very blunt. And you know, the Coalition for Choice in Housing has noted several instances in which they believe that it's overly broad, and they've collected the stories of some of their residents who believe that they've come into conflict with this rule, particularly in terms of applying for funding from MHFA. I'll let Ethan cover some more of those details if you have further inquiry along that line. But the idea, to go back to your question, the idea was to promote scattered site housing and to do so in a cost-effective manner. We believe that the exemptions process simply sharpens and refines that tool. It continues the push towards scattered site housing, but it allows good, high-quality projects that have a demonstrated need to move forward in a reasonable manner.
Okay, and no further questions? Then let's move on to the next witness. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you just introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Sean Burke. I'm an attorney at the Minnesota Disability Law Center, and as you've already heard, we have been involved in what we call a negotiation process to put this exception process into place. What I'd offer to you, Madam Chair, is to go through, you've heard the exception process now, talked about what is it, and we'd offer now to go through that process for you and highlight what it looks like.
Thank you. Why don't you do that?
So working off the DE1 amendment is what I'll be looking at. You'll notice subdivision 2, the exception process is really contained in subdivision 2, which starts on line 2.13. And I turn your attention first to subdivision 2A. What the exception process does is it keeps in place that 25% cap that you've heard about, that 25% restriction. That's still in law. If a developer, provider, or owner wants to develop a property or manage a property that would be in conflict with that restriction, then they would have to go through an application process. And that application process would be sent in and evaluated by DHS. So that's first part, subdivision 2A, simply acknowledges that that an application is going to have to be made. There is another important piece that a developer, operator, owner can also get an exception from, not just the 25% restriction, but there's another restriction currently in the Minnesota definition of setting, and that is that a housing complex cannot be designed expressly around an individual's diagnosis or disability. This is kind of commonly what we've come to refer to as disability-purposed housing. And a lot of members of the Coalition for Choice were concerned that they might get an exception from the 25% rule, but then their building would also potentially be held up because it was seen as disability-purposed. This is something that CMS has also wrestled with and decided to go a different direction. The exception process simply will allow a provider, owner, or operator to get an exception from either the 25% or the disability-purposed or both of them. If there's any questions there, I'll move on to what's actually in the application. So subdivision 2B notes that the application is going to have four main things. The first three there are that they simply affirm that they meet all the requirements of what a community setting already is in law. Those are already in statute. They also have to explain, B2, they have to explain why they're asking for the exception. What we're really concerned about is that providers are really aware of who their clients are, what the needs are. So this asks them to get in depth a little bit about, you know, why do you feel like you need an exception from the 25% rule? And I turn it over to Ethan a little bit to explain how a provider might kind of interpret this requirement.
So let me give you an example from one of the agencies which I'm working with. Sorry, again, Ethan Roberts from the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and the Dakotas. For what it's worth, we too are celebrating our 75th anniversary this year. Not dedicated to housing issues, though, so I'm a little bit of a newbie both to the issue and obviously to the committee. So Jewish Housing Programming, which is the agency which I'm working most closely with, has purchased land in Golden Valley to build an apartment complex for primarily young adults in their 20s and 30s who have developmental disabilities, many of whom right now, for example, are living in group homes. And this is not a hypothetical. This is actually a situation which has happened on more than one occasion. Let's say you're the only Jewish adult living in that group home, and the other three people are Christian. And the activity on Sunday morning is you go to church, because that's what everyone else would like to do. There's nothing wrong with going to church if you're Christian, but if you're Jewish, it's a little awkward. And so, in part, why Jewish Housing and Programming exists is so that young Jewish adults who we've worked very hard with to include in synagogues and in youth groups and in all aspects of Jewish life continue to have those opportunities to be included as they age, as they get older. other, you'll hear from Zach in a few minutes, and he'll explain why he enjoys living at ASI. The reasons why people would want to live in the kind of housing that we provide are as varied as the individual. And something that I think is really important for you guys to understand from our perspective is that we have never said, and we do not even believe internally, that our models are the right model for all people. We know they're not. We know that people are successful at all sorts of models, including and especially perhaps scattered-site housing. We do, however, know our model is the right for some people. We know this because we have waiting lists. And so we believe that through this exceptions process, we have a balance of choice and yet accountability and the integration, which we'll continue to talk about. But there are a million different reasons. Well, a million sounds a bit of an exaggeration, but there are a plethora of reasons why people would want this kind of housing, and it really is very individual specific.
Thank you.
So moving on, what's in the application? The provider, the applicant, will also have to explain how they support individuals choosing the option. This word choice is actually was a big part of our negotiations, and actually when the CMS rule is implemented, one of the requirements for setting under the new HCBS setting requirements by CMS is that a person would have had to chosen their place out of among options. And so here in Minnesota, oftentimes a lot of our clients at the Disability Law Center, we're worried that the only reason they're living where they are was because it was the only option presented. There were no other true options. So requiring an applicant to explain how they are supporting this concept of choice, we feel is important. And then the fourth thing that they're going to have to do is fairly involved. They're going to have to explain through a quality assurance plan other aspects of their program and their building that truly support integration and kind of person-centered services. I'm not going to go through all of those in depth, but you'll see those starting on line 3.1. There are a number of things that the applicant's going to have to affirm that they do in their setting. And these were important to a lot of us advocates who are concerned that sometimes providers, developers, organizers are simply about building the building and not necessarily about looking at the broader picture of the needs of individuals with disabilities. So things like supporting scattered site alternatives, supporting transition if it's appropriate for the individual, so that maybe this housing where everyone else also has a disability, maybe it's a temporary setup, and really what is going to happen is they're going to transition to a scattered site or even more independent setting. We want organizations to show that they have a history of meeting recognized quality standards, and that they also provide and facilitate access to the community. This tracks really closely with the new CMS regulation. Any questions on what's needed to be in the quality assurance plan?
Okay,
all right, and then the next aspect of the application process is, okay, someone's applied, what's DHS going to do with it? So the next section simply spells out some more of the procedural aspect of the application, when it needs to be turned in, how long DHS has to evaluate it, how they evaluate it. One of the things that we think is important is that DHS, as a large organization, has many different divisions that work with different populations, and we want to make sure that each of those divisions working with different populations are considering the application if that application deals with their population. So, for example, a provider wants to build a 100% building with everyone in there needing mental health services. They're going to have to, most of their clients might receive the CADI waiver, which is one of the Medicaid waivers. That would technically be contrary to the 25% rule, so they submitted an exception process. They meet all of these guidelines. We want to make sure that the mental health professionals at DHS are also in conversation and know that this building is going up and having conversation. And then the other thing DHS needs to do is submit the plan for public comment and get feedback from the public as well. Then it spells out what DHS can do if the application is not satisfactory or if they decide to decline the application. And there are some, generally I'll call them kind of appeals provisions. And then the final piece of this bill is a continuation. We felt it was really important, the conversations we've had between advocates from all different sides of this issue, that we continue the conversation, especially in context of the new CMS rule needed to be implemented. So the public input on the exception process, starting at line 4.4, is simply directing the department to create a stakeholder group, particularly on this exceptions process, so that the implementation and some more of the criteria about how these applications are actually going to be evaluated inside DHS is worked out, not just by our partners at the department, but also all the stakeholders who've been at the table and other stakeholders who would be relevant as well. That is a short nutshell of 3 or 4 months of conversation and crafting of this process. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Green, who was first? Representative Anderson. You're first, then Representative Green. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. Going back to line 1 on page 3, if somebody applies for the exemption, does that mean they have to then develop other scattered site housing to make that exemption application possible?
Wonderful question. No. Our intent is that they affirm and show that they're actually supporting the concept of scattered site. I'll let Ethan, Mr. Roberts, explain that a little bit more, because this was at least a 2.5-hour conversation at one point. So
I'll spare you the 2.5-hour conversation. Very simply, some of our members do actually develop scattered site alternatives. Some do not, for a variety of reasons, including institutional capacity. But I think the point, as Mr. Burke was illustrating, is that it's important that we support it, and we do. And I think that's I have no issue affirming that we support it. We support everything in this bill. This is our bill that we work together collaboratively. There's nothing in this which I disagree with. For example, this idea of transitioning people to more integrated settings. Let's just say all we are is a landlord. Now, if I was a typical kind of landlord, I would probably sign my tenants up for a 12-month lease. And let's say they found something that better suited their needs. Well, if that's after 6 or 7 months, they still need to pay me the additional 5 months. As landlords in this type of setting, we wouldn't do that. We would work with somebody to move them to a situation which they felt was better for them. And honestly, it will not be an issue for us because we have a waiting list. And so even as a landlord, as someone who's not a case manager, who doesn't provide services, there's still things we can do to be supportive of allowing people to be in the best setting for them based upon their individual needs.
One other example is a provider who doesn't have the institutional capacity to develop scattered site could support it by building partnerships with other providers who do. And that's really one of the real kind of impetus behind the 25% cap, is that it has the potential to spurn innovation like that in a way where if we lifted the cap and providers could just create disability-purposed housing, might not happen. So that's the concept of support.
Thank you. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like a little clarification, and because I'm not sure I'm reading this right, but if you go from line 3.32 all the way through 4.8, if I get some clarification there, because it on the application process, if I'm reading this right, and stop me if I'm not, that the person who applies for the application, if it's granted, and someone then moves into that facility, they have 60 days to notify the commissioner. And if they don't notify the commissioner, the application can be suspended, but there'll be 90 days to correct it. And so you're looking at 5 months. And then in 4.3, it talks about if an exception is approved and later revoked, no tenant shall be displaced as a result of the revocation until a relocation plan has been implemented that provides for an acceptable alternative, which, if I'm reading that right, goes on indefinitely, and then or could. And then in 4.6, it looks like it removes the requirement to even apply for an exemption if certain requirements are met. So if you could just explain those
Madam Chair, just briefly, I think you were referring to the D3 language. So just if folks are trying to follow along, you might want to jump to the D3 language for those lines. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Yes, I was like, oh, right, the D3, of course.
Or Mr. Roberts.
Right, thank you. So starting on line 3.32 of the D3 amendment, and this, by the way, is paralleled on line 3.30 of the DE1 amendment. The idea here is that, let's assume that my client, JHAP, goes through the exceptions process and makes certain promises about what it's going to be like, how we're going to meet all of these requirements, and we operate for 6 months a year, it doesn't matter, and we stop doing those things, or we materially change how we operate in a way that if we had been that way, we would never have gotten through the exceptions process. We feel that it's fair for a housing setting to inform the commissioner of you know, the Department of Human Services, of these changes. And if the commissioner moving through the Section E in the D3 amendment feels as though we've made a material change, that we could be suspended and that we would have a period of time to correct the modifications which resulted in suspension. Now, hopefully this won't happen, but if it does and it's still not cured, that 4.3 in the D3 amendment anticipates that the exception could actually be revoked. But it does note, as you say, it is open-ended, and perhaps as we move through the process, we need to set X number of months to create this relocation plan. The idea being a tenant shouldn't become homeless overnight because of the failure of the place where they live. I think it's important for people to know that this idea of a suspension and then the actual revocation of the exception was something that the Coalition for Choice to Housing brought to the table. This was something that we felt was important because we have no interest in moving forward with having providers go through the exceptions process and then offer poor quality, so the good apples which go rotten, because that will make all of us look bad, it will provide bad outcomes for people, and so we thought this was important, and obviously the other stakeholders went along with that, but you should know this came from us. Okay, yes. Point G in line 4.6, I'm sorry, you're right. The point here was to make it clear, and this was originally the language in the D1 amendment in line 2.14, which talked about the discretion of the organization. So it's the same idea, which is that an organization, a setting, a landlord, it's always their discretion, their right to go through the exceptions process. They are not required to do it. They can or they don't. But it's always up to them that this government, the state, the law is not requiring them to go through the process. Probably we're being a little bit more cautious than we need to be, but the idea would be, let's assume people in the community really want a given setting to go through the process, and we say, you know, we really don't want to. What if they bring a lawsuit and sort of try to compel us to go through the process? This makes it very clear that it's the discretion of the setting to go through the process or not. That's what the point of the G provision in the D3 amendment is. That's what the point in the D1 amendment of the opening language of at the discretion of. I hope that's clear.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thank you for clarifying that. That was I was afraid I was reading it wrong, so I'm glad that you did that. And I guess the one thing that I worry about is why the law was put in place to begin with. I mean, I understand the reasoning behind, you know, not wanting the institutionalized setting, but you know, I guess seeing as how it just came in fast, I would just like a little more time to look it over, because it seems common sense, it makes me wonder if there's not something in there, why the law was enacted in the first place. Was there a problem before, or you know, how bad was the problem before this law was put into effect? If that, and then that's all I need to know.
Yep. Madam Chair, Representative, I believe the law was put in place for several reasons. One of them was there was a, I hate to use this term, but really a warehousing of folks with disabilities in, you know, these settings that had many people, and they weren't being provided the services that they needed. So I think that's one of the reasons. I would venture to guess that Mr. Burke would have a much deeper knowledge on the subject than I do.
Madam Chair, I think that's... I think that's a key understanding, is that the concept of limiting the amount of people on a certain waiver in a building is a way to prevent providers and others from building institutional-like settings, or perhaps places that might look like residences or regular apartments, but really just institutions in another name. And actually, our partners from the mental health coalitions can speak more to specific examples of those kind of traumas in that community. I would say another reason, I'm not going to rehash a lot of legislative history, but there's also a cost factor involved when it comes to approving new sites for waivered services. And so I believe, you know, the original 25% cap was a part of a larger bill where the department estimated that there'd be pretty high costs involved if that was not put in place. So multiple reasons for the 25% cap.
All right, good job. Any other questions?
We have another testimony.
Ms. MD, did you have another witness?
Yeah, we have another testifier here. Okay. Zach would like to come up and speak on behalf of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Just introduce yourself, please.
First of all, can everybody hear me okay?
I think so. Go ahead.
My name is Zach Johnson, and I live in a building which provides housing along with 24-hour attendance service. And this 24-hour attendance service is very critical for me in order to, it allows me to do three things. It allows me to do three things. Finish school. I graduated from the University of Minnesota with a degree in sports marketing and management and a minor in political science with honors. And I was able to do that because the 24-hour service allowed me to stay up till 11 o'clock if I needed to write a term paper, or for employment. How do you think in this economy, what do you think they would do with a resume if I said, they said, can you start tomorrow? And I said, well, I have to check with my PCA first to make sure there's someone there to get me out of bed. if I was somebody's legislative assistant or something. And they said, can you stay over to get this tax bill written for me?
Not me.
what do you think you would say if I said, well, I don't know if I can be here for the vote tonight because I don't know if there's going to be someone to put me to bed when I go home. Sorry, representative. I don't think that would work out very well. I think you might hire someone else. So what this allows me to do is exercise my full potential to get that first job that can lift me out of poverty, which will allow me to go to other options if I choose. But if you don't get that first job and you can't be the guy that works the hardest, the smartest, the fastest, you probably won't do it, especially in this economy. So my services are dealt with in a way that I don't have to worry about it, and I can live at the pace that society expects me to live at, and that I expect myself to live at. So, if there's any further questions, I'd be more than happy to take them.
Any questions for Mr. Johnson? Representative Dean.
I'm curious. I'm a little bit worried. By chance, do you live in my district? Because I think I might be vulnerable in the future.
I live in Representative Lincheski's.
Okay. So, she should be worried.
And she's the back chair.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Let's see, Representative Metza, did you have your hand up?
Just more of a comment. I wanted to point out, first off, nice pinstripe suit. I wore mine yesterday. and secondly, I really think you just gave one of the most compelling testimonies I've heard since I've been here, and really appreciate you taking the time to come down and really support the idea behind the bill in making sure that you get those things that you're looking for to live your own productive life in your own way.
And just to give you a little more background,
Mr. Johnson.
I was carried to my first day of kindergarten at a school on the Iron Range because there was no elevator in my school. So if this bill wasn't going towards the arc of justice for people with disability, I wouldn't be supporting it.
Thank you. Looks like Representative Mensah has another comment.
Well, you did bring up the range, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out, and if you'll provide me a little latitude here, we do have a great school bill in right now for a co-located high school to upgrade many of our facilities on the range that were built in the teens. So
I'm a ranger at heart, so I will never fault the range for anything. But
okay. Representative Hertas.
Madam Chair, thank you, and Mr. Johnson, thank you for your testimony. Members, I think oftentimes we see evidence, as this might be the case, of legislation that gets passed in a poor form or hastily, and certainly the previous legislation that this bill seeks to address is demonstrating that the unintended consequences weren't well thought out. With that said, Representative Dean, I think it's wonderful that you identify a problem and that you get both sides together in whether there's opposition against, or support for something, that you can hammer out the differences. And I won't speak for the rest of my caucus, but frankly, I have no problem with supporting this legislation, and thank you for bringing it forth.
Thank you. Representative Schumacher.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairs and members. And to Representative Hertas's point, as the author of the 25% portion of that poorly worded and illustrated piece of legislation, I'm very supportive of what was being done today. Before that, it was just the four that was in statute, and that was very arbitrary. It meant four, even if it was a 100-unit complex, there was only four. And at the time, there were a lot of moving parts to the particular bill we were working on, and this was one of those that there just wasn't enough agreement on fast enough to get it done. And so we wanted to, of course, do more, but we couldn't at the time. And I'm glad to see that this is going through. I want to thank Representative Dean for working on this and getting people together to do this and move forward with it, because I think it's going to help a lot of the different groups that can benefit from this. And just want to thank him for that, and will offer my support.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to echo that, too. Thank you, Representative Dean, for bringing this forward. And during the interim, I had this fantastic opportunity because my husband does most of my business, and so I get to do other fun things. But I got to go to Hammer I got to go to REM and Dakota Communities and a few other very small kind of individual homes. And so I'm incredibly supportive because this is echoed in all those places that I went. This particular issue was raised multiple times, and it I don't know if you've been working with those group homes as well, with those places with Hammer, with REM, and Dakota Communities, but I know that in speaking with them in my district and even outside my district, I went even beyond and visited some other places outside my district just to get a better perspective. But, you know, I thank you for bringing this forward, and I also echo my colleagues that I would support this, and I thank you for bringing it, and thank you so much for your testimony today. That was incredible testimony. I represent that says right. That was the best testimony I think I've heard this session, so thank you.
Okay, well, it sounds, members, like we really vetted the D3 amendment here. Would you be okay? Is there anyone who would object to having the D3 amendment put on? If you do, we'll wait and have them come back another time. But if we're okay with it, we'll go ahead and do that. And if not, it's either way is fine. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. You know, I had earlier said that I would like to see it not acted upon today, but we have a real feeling of kumbaya here in the committee.
Seems like it.
let's keep this going. You know, it's a good bill. But I would just encourage all of us to meet the deadlines from here on down and forward, and I would be okay also with letting us act on the D3.
Thank you. Would you like to make the motion to adopt the D3 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Anderson moves the D3 amendment. Okay, there's a technical language here that says amend the title accordingly. Representative Anderson, just for the committee report, are you okay with that? Doesn't change anything in the bill. Okay, the D3 amendment is before us. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Okay, any further discussion, members? Right, we have another bill, we have another presentation, but right now this... Is there anybody else who wants to testify in this bill? Anybody? Okay. I didn't think so. Okay. So the... On this
one? Oh.
Okay. So the bill is before us as amended. House File 1992. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails, and House File 1992 is on its way to Health and Human Services.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and if I could just give a closing comment.
Representative Dean, I'm sorry. I didn't give you a chance to do that.
That's fine. I'll just be brief. I think that this bill is really the effort of many people sitting down and having hard conversations and coming to an agreement that ultimately gets more than gets less. So I'm proud to be a part of this and look forward to conversations on down the road at Health and Human Services as well as hopefully when we get to the floor. So thank you again.
Thank you. Members, my trustworthy assistant here is telling me that I should have said the motion a little bit differently. We're not using the word pass anymore. We're saying the motion is to refer it to Health and Human Services. So with that caveat, we will refer it to Health and Human Services policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill is now on its way, correctly. I thank you all. Members, you did a great job. I think everyone here really helped us all understand that bill, so thank you. Now we have a presentation from the Minnesota Housing Finance. We're not done. We have the Housing Finance Agency. Hold on, everybody. We have the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to make a presentation to us. And we will get the minutes. It looks like Representative Radinovich might want us to pass the minutes.
I do.
Representative Radinovich moves the passage of, or the exception of, accepting of the minutes from, what's the date? March 3rd. Any discussion on those minutes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Now we'll take the minutes from February 26th. Any discussion on the minutes from February 26th? Not all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and those minutes are approved and adopted. Ms. Orr, welcome from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tanya Orr with the Housing Finance Agency. I was asked today to come and update you on the use of the appropriations that you adopted last year for the Housing Finance Agency. Just as a quick refresher, $101 million was appropriated to the agency for the fiscal year 14-15 biennium. Roughly $58 million is available for the first year of the biennium and $42 million in the second year of the biennium. This appropriation of $101 million includes $10 million for the governor's housing and job growth initiative, as well as $2.5 million for two rental assistance initiatives the governor proposed. One was is for highly mobile students to stabilize them in their housing, and the other is for $500,000 for a reentry initiative.
Excuse me, Pam, sorry.
No problem. The appropriation funded 10 programs and four grants to specific organizations. As you may know, remember, the agency distributes almost all of its appropriations through a competitive process. Only two of the programs are available on a pipeline non-competitive process, and I'll explain that in a minute. After RFPs are issued, staff reviews the various applications and then makes recommendations to our board of directors, who will act on the selections and either approve or not approve the staff's recommendations. We issued several RFPs early in the spring in anticipation of receiving appropriations so that we could have money available and under contract by July 1st, the start of the fiscal year. We also issued a consolidated RFP in April with applications due in midsummer and selections going to the board for approval in the end of October. This consolidated RFP included funding for the Challenge Program, the Preservation Program, the agency's first mortgage loan program for rental housing, and the federal housing income tax credit program. As of the end of this month, of the $58 million that is available for the first year of the biennium, 90% of that money is committed. We have... As I mentioned, we issued a number of RFPs, some of them for the Housing Trust Fund, the Bridges Program, and the Family Homeless Prevention Program. We awarded both the years of the biennium's funding in one application. We have awarded half of the money that was available for the the Housing and Jobs Growth Initiative. One of the purposes of that initiative was to try and encourage employers to make contributions to affordable housing, and we did in fact succeed in encouraging several employers to make substantial contributions to affordable housing. You have in front of you a packet of information that is the selections from the consolidated RFP. They are arranged by both rental housing, Metro, and Greater Minnesota, and single family or home ownership, both Metro and then Greater Minnesota. These selections that the board approved in early November will help almost 1,900 households have affordable housing. With the appropriations that you provided for the first year of the biennium, we estimate that we will serve over 28,000 households. This is out of an estimated 62,000 households that we serve in a year. The other document you have in front of you is our annual program assessment. It is a report of all the activities that we engage in over the year. This is something that we prepare annually. It is available for those in the audience. It is available online as well. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, committee members, and thank you for coming. We are happy to get a chance to kind of catch up on what's happened with our expenditures that we put forward last year. And if committee members remember, we, for the first time, you know, really took a big step forward and did put some, for the first time in about a decade, put some additional money into the agency and put it into the base. So, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to, a couple things I want to echo with the Chair. The Chair just shared, and I thought it was important that we, after, quite frankly, in my opinion, many years of disinvestment, took some strong steps forward. This committee actually had, I believe, an even more assertive stance initially, which I think was totally supportable, you know, based on our most recent years of disinvestment. But I think we did some really good work, and I want to commend the department. I know it's been only a short period of time since the last appropriation, but I think the direction is all moving in the correct way. I do want to focus in on a very specific issue. And if you recall, Commissioner, last year at the beginning, I had asked questions around this small set of activities around capacity building and land trusts. I actually have some affordable housing that's been developed in my district using the land trust instrument. So I know, excuse me, some of the actors in this area, and as I testified, or as I stated last year, I'm also aware that they are constantly operating a pretty thin operational, you know, resources. The terrific people that do play a small but important role in creating affordable housing opportunities for folks, and so I what I'm hearing is that, frankly, Commissioner, that they've asked for clarification about eligibility to access capacity building funds, with which, Madam Chair, as you probably recall, because you and I have been here a while. You know, were initially designed specifically in part to assist land trusts. So that goes back a few years. And apparently, Commissioner, they haven't received a response back from the department about, you know, clarifying their eligibility in terms of accessing the capacity building funds. And so, particularly in light of the investments that we made over and above, you know, what was considered base, you know, a year ago, it seems to me that this is an opportune time for the department, for the agency, to strongly revisit, you know, this issue of capacity building for these land trusts, nonprofits, and at the very least, make it real clear for them, you know, what their eligibility requirements are. And at the very most, you know, include them in part as part of our investment in entities that provide affordable housing. So there's a lot there, but I mean, basically, frankly, I'm making a statement here because I'm a little disappointed based on what I'm hearing back from the field, and I would certainly offer you an opportunity to share and update us. At this point on this particular issue, and I would certainly look forward to working with you on ways in which we can move forward to have our housing finance agency be a powerful, partner with our land trust organizations across the state.
Thank you.
I'm sorry? Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I appreciate your comments. We have, I think, been a very important partner with the land trust in funding their requests. We, as you can see from the materials that I handed out, that we, in the last year, funded a number of community land trusts for projects that they are pursuing. We also, unlike a lot of housing finance agencies, fund the underlying first mortgage for the home buyer. There are difficulties in the financing world about funding, providing money for mortgages for land properties that are in land trusts. We have overcome those and have and are the probably largest, I'm sure largest, if not pretty close to only source of mortgage financing for properties for home buyers who are buying in community land trusts. We have had recent conversations or at least communications with the Community Land Trust Coalition about another issue, but not about capacity building. I would just remind you that the funding for the capacity building program is $750,000 for the biennium for the state. We have considerable demands on that money for the continuum of care programs throughout the state, as well as other entities. We do fund the Local Initiative Support Corporation, who then provides capacity building money to developers and others. And I know for certain that in Duluth, the Community Land Trust is a recipient of that money. So I'd be happy to look into this issue more, but like all the other programs that we have, there's a significant demand. And as I mentioned, we have been a big supporter of the work that the Community Land Trust do.
Madam Chair.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, again, you know, I set the context for my comments, you know, based on the good work that I believe this agency does. I think it's an incredible asset to our state to have the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, and I get the funding projects part. The issue is that there are capacity, operational capacity issues for these organizations. The fact is that we had a history at one time of being very directive about having resources flow through the MHFA in order to provide capacity, you know, building opportunities precisely for land trust agencies. And in addition, I know that there are plenty of accounts that MHFA has that we don't have anything to do with, that you properly do invest and send out in support of our common goals of affordable housing. And so when I add all that up, you know, we're not talking about multi-million dollar requests, you know, to support these small entities that are doing phenomenal work, playing out a vital key, one key instrument that can produce affordable housing. And so I just really want to publicly be very forceful about my expectation that our housing finance agency play a yet even stronger role relative to this particular need with these entities. And I totally get the complexities involved, the demands. You're absolutely right, the demands are huge in our state. Hopefully one of the things we'll do this year is pass a powerful bonding proposal that will begin to make a pretty big nick at, you know, at some of our other housing needs around the state. I totally get that. Totally get that. But again, what I'm hearing back is that the needs continue to be there. I really want our housing finance agency and us to kind of step it up a little bit more so we can find more creative ways to be able to be supportive of these really terrific small organizations. I do thank you for the relationships that you have with them now, for the work that you're doing. This is not meant, you know, to be a criticism of MHFA as much as a challenge, you know, for us to find yet a more creative, powerful way to help these small operations continue to operate. So I look forward to working with you on that.
Thank you. Representative Isaacson, I think you're next.
Thank you for being here today. I just have a couple questions for you that I want to understand. And as I continue to learn and see, there's just every question you can answer, there's two more questions, it seems like, up here. And so, I want to just take a step back, first of all, to the whole process of how we allocate money to MHFA. And my understanding is your budget, and I don't know if it's this past biennium or just for 2014, was about $108 million. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, the state appropriations was $58 million for fiscal year 14.
Okay, but how much did you guys end up spending of your own money as well in fiscal year 14?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, I can answer the question about the total expenditures for fiscal year 13 because fiscal year 14 isn't over yet. Mm-hmm. So the total expenditures were $781 million. You can find that on page 20 of the program assessment. You will note that a large part of that funding is home buyer mortgages, $375 million, and another large part of that is federal funds for Section 8 contract administration, $182 million.
Okay. So I think that the question – I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the question I have is that I feel as though – and I think this might be going forward just so I have a better understanding. When I was – supporting and pushing forward to the baseline amount that we asked for, which was a nice increase as last time and carried the bill, I don't think that my understanding that it was clear to me now. I would have asked, should have asked the question, what is the worth of the organization? What is the money you have aside already? How much do you already plan on spending? Where are the pots of revenue coming from? And then how does the money we're giving you supplement that, right? And I'm just a little curious as to how we how that is taken into account when you're creating your own budget. And I realize that it's probably very complicated because there's different pots going different where, and I imagine also there's times in which our money is leveraging other money. And so to the extent that which you can kind of help me through the process you guys go through, that'd be really helpful.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, certainly. I think what's critical to keep in mind is that not all money can be used in the same ways. So we have different sources of funding. The largest source of funding is our bond funds. So that is those are funds that are available because we issue debt. These are revenue bonds, and we must repay that debt. So that is not money that we can use for affordability gap or mm-hmm. value gap mm-hmm. or rental assistance. Mm-hmm. It is money that we can use for first mortgages, and that mm-hmm. is the bulk of the $381 million that I referenced earlier, mm-hmm. that's or $375 million that mm-hmm. was used for first-time home buyers primarily.
Okay.
So that is the largest chunk of money. The other large source of funding is from the federal government. Mm-hmm. The agency is responsible for the vast majority of the contract administration for Section 8 buildings that were developed back in the 80s primarily. And so we get money from the federal government to make payments to Section 8 property owners to fulfill their contracts with the federal government.
Okay.
So that is another almost $200 million of the agency's annual budget is that money that we have no discretion over.
Right.
Other than
right.
to say, you know, your housing quality standards weren't there or something. But otherwise, it's money that we really have no discretion over. Because the agency has existed for about 40 years, and has been issuing mortgages for about that long. Mm-hmm. We do get payments on the mortgages, sure. And we issue the generally, and it's not always true, and it's certainly been a struggle in the last few years with the financial crisis, but generally the interest rate that we pay on the bonds is slightly lower than the interest rate at which we lend the money out at.
Okay.
Now, part of that is because the way the agency was structured is vastly different than most state agencies in that 100% of the money that you appropriate to the agency goes for programs
right.
to help individuals.
Right.
It does not go for the operations of the agency.
Right.
So we have to find the money to operate the agency. We are the second largest issuer of tax-exempt bonds. That comes with a lot of strings. So we have to do a lot of disclosure. There are a number of things that we have to do. So over the years, we have, as we pay bonds off, we have some money that is above and beyond what we need to make the debt payments. We pay, we use that money for the operations of the agency.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have more in a year than we have, than we need for the operations of the agency. That money is budgeted and approved by the board. It has been used for a variety of activities, all of which we have to have statutory authority for.
Mm-hmm.
The most significant use of that money in recent years has been to help support the plan to end long-term homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
So it is used. The board is approves the budget every year, and that money is so the board has to approve the uses of the whatever money we estimate will be available.
Okay.
It is not money that we have in the bank, but it is money that we earn over the course of the year, and we estimate how much we would have.
Gotcha. And so,
Representative Isaacson.
This is really helpful here, but I'm wondering, is there a graph in here that demonstrates the different sources of income and total giving me that? I see you answered my question on page 20 about the expenditures in the budget, and I'm just wondering, is there also one here that walks me through? Because I realize that you're absolutely, you know, some of it is just stuff you got to spend in certain ways. It's not a discretionary thing, but I would like to know if there's a way to see the entire budget in terms of where the money is coming from and all the income that's coming in as well, so I can just have an idea of that.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, we used to have a pie chart, which I don't see in this document, but I'm fairly certain, but not 100% certain, that it is in the budget documents. So in the agency profile page,
great.
The first page
I'll
of the
there.
Profile, there
sure.
is, for certain, there is a reference to this, but and I know in some years we've had a pie chart. I don't
yeah.
remember if it was in the last year or not.
Okay, that'd be helpful, Madam Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
All right, so moving on from that, that's really helpful for me to see that, and I'll take a look on the agency page about that. Thank you very much. Specific to a couple of areas, I have some questions on how we arrived where we did on the funding that we spent money on, and some of it's just my own curiosity, having followed it and voted on it last time, but specifically to the Challenge Fund.
Mm-hmm.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but $10 million was set aside specific for job growth.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, how did we spend that money, and why? And where are we at? I mean, we haven't spent it all yet, so.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, we announced $5 million of the $10 million in the RFP that was released last April, with applications due in midsummer and the board selections in the early November. We announced the $5 million and we committed the $5
million. Right.
We did that. We specifically did not announce the full $10 million because we believed that there were communities that had housing needs that weren't maybe far enough along to have
sure.
a competitive application, so we wanted to give them another year. Let's see if I can remember. There were projects were funded with that money in Duluth, in Roseau, in Thief River Falls, in Jackson, and in Minneapolis is my recollection, but it's all it is in the documents that I presented and provided you. And
these right here?
Yes.
Okay. And so, I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you if you have more.
And I just wanted to say that we defined areas of job growth as our research staff looked at areas where there actually had been experiencing job growth, or areas where workers were commuting long distances. And then we gave applicants an opportunity to say, well, if you're not in an area that we have defined as a job growth area, then give us the data that supports your application that you are in a job growth area. The other criteria that I forgot to mention was low vacancy rates. So you have an indication that there's a need for additional housing.
And so when you say the $5 million has been committed, does that mean that hasn't been maybe, or you're not through the process 100% yet? Is that right? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, sorry. What that means is that we have, the board has approved funding for a project. In most cases, we provide the financing as an end loan, so we're not dispersing the money until the project is done.
Got it.
So money is committed now. We will, some of the projects that we committed money to in November will start construction this spring.
Great.
Some may not start until the summer. So we may not see closed loans for 18 months. That's very common. We think the critical point is at which point have we committed funds?
Mm-hmm.
Because then the project knows it can go forward or it
right. can't. That's helpful. That distinction is very helpful. So, and these funds can be used in the metro area just as much as you said, yes. Minneapolis, right, mm-hmm. or the east side. Okay. And so do you do private matches with that? Is that required?
Sir.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, the Housing and Jobs Growth Initiative was an appropriation to the Challenge Program.
Mm-hmm.
Statutorily, the Challenge Program does require that half of the money be used in projects that there is a non-state contribution.
Good.
So we give a priority to projects that leverage other funds. So it is quite common in particularly projects that are intended to serve, provide workforce housing, mm-hmm. to have a significant contribution from the private sector, whether it's philanthropic, and then also from the local units of government.
And do you have any sense? I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. Let's get used to this again.
Okay.
Do you have any sense of what, how much you've been able to leverage based on, and how much you've actually off the $5 million?
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, I didn't bring that information with me, but I can tell you, I can quickly get you the total development costs
mm-hmm.
of all of the projects that were funded
mm-hmm.
as compared to the state funding of mm-hmm. those projects, and that would give you a sense of the leverage.
And
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. And so that'd be really great to have. That'd be very helpful. And so that's $5 million of it, and then the next $5 million, we're doing another RFP. We're waiting for, and we're in the process of. Or how, where are we at with that?
So Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, the next RFP will be issued in mid-April.
Okay.
We have for a long time tried to be on a predictable schedule,
which is
and
good.
So we are typically issue an RFP in mid-April, with applications due in mid-summer, and selections made at the end of October.
Madam Chair. So, in the process of, you had listed four areas and then Minneapolis, right? Mm-hmm. And I am also on the Jobs Committee. And on the Jobs Committee, one of the things we've identified is a real housing problem in terms of the lack of it to support the kind of jobs we have. And, like, I think it's Brainerd and up in the northwest part of the state. And I'm just wondering, I don't think that these, other than maybe Roseau, are in that same, especially in the kind of expansion we're looking at. I'm wondering, do you have to only wait for people to submit plans, or can you go out and look for places to go as well? Or what's the dynamic there between those two tensions? Who is asking, and where the need is, even if they're not asking, and how does that work with you guys?
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, we have taken an approach of because we're government, we need to be very transparent, and we need to make sure that everyone is treated equally. So we do wait until we get applications, but we have taken the approach of providing as much technical assistance as we can. So if anyone calls and says, I have an idea for a project, we say, great. Come in and talk to us, and we'll tell you how you can make it through our process and get funded. In many cases, we are hearing from organizations that aren't experienced developers, and we encourage them to partner with experienced developers. We also have, we have staff who spends a great deal of time out in communities talking about agency resources. We have for several years now conducted what we call community dialogues, where we will go to a community, work with the community to bring together the right people to talk about what their housing needs are and what resources might be available from the state, what resources the city itself might have, and what resources others in the community might have to meet those affordable housing needs. So it's we don't make any promises when we go to these community dialogues, but we do try and get people to talk about what are their needs and how can we meet those.
Okay. Representative Isaacson.
So in the last year, to your knowledge, and you may not have knowledge, and that's completely understandable, but do you know if you've been engaged by those folks up in northwestern Minnesota? Is it, and I'm trying to remember if it's, I'm going to get it mixed up, if it's Bemidji or Brainerd, but I know specifically there's areas where they literally can't expand jobs because they don't have, is it Brainerd? Yeah. Where they don't have, they just don't have the housing, affordable housing to do that. And I think that's a real hindrance to our economy when we're not able to, you know, an ironic kind of problem to have considering the recession, that now we're in a spot where we have jobs and no place to put people. And so I would assume that that's some sort of a priority in that respect. And I don't see on the list here, and I know maybe you're not allowed to necessarily advocate, but where are we at with those folks, just as an example of an area that seems to be identified by many people as a real high-need area?
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, I think the Brainerd-Bemidji area has a similar problem to areas that we did fund. Uh-huh. For instance, Thief River Falls, we heard repeatedly that DigiKey could not expand because there wasn't affordable housing.
Right, right.
We hear that from Polaris in Roseau, and projects in both those communities were funded in this last funding round. And I honestly can't remember whether it was Bemidji or Brainerd. I think it was Bemidji, where we had a community dialogue, which has proven to be sometimes a good first step to getting people to come together and talk about what is the community's need and what sort of projects would we like to propose to the state. I don't have the non-selects in front of me, so I can't tell you whether whether we got an application from them or not, but the situation that you're describing is exactly the one that the Housing and Job Growth Initiative was intended to address. It is only $10 million, so we're not going to be able to do every community in this biennium, but we certainly are working on it.
One last question.
Okay, I'm just, this will be the last question for you, and then I think, I know Representative Hertoff has a question. I have some questions. I think we're going to have you come back, but go ahead, Representative Isaacson.
My last question has five parts. Just kidding. So here's my question. I'm looking at also some of the appropriations that we have that you guys spent money on in the affordable housing program budget, and Habitat, Next 1,000 Homes, and some of these other places that we didn't appropriate money directly to, but you ended up spending money on anyways. How does that work? And where does the money come from if we're not appropriating it for these programs?
That's two questions.
Told you it was five parts. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Isaacson, that the source of that funding is the money that I referred to. That's the difference between the bonds that we issued that we have to repay and the loans that we made. So when we have excesses, which some years we don't, but when we have excesses, then the board makes a decision about how that money would be spent. And the legislature, Representative Clark will remember this, maybe in 1990, made a substantial commitment to Habitat. We have not been able, it was in the $50 million range, we have not been able to continue that commitment, but have taken the direction from the legislature of the importance of Habitat and have provided some additional money.
Okay. So, Representative Portas, I'm going to make sure that you can ask your question, because I think you mentioned I might have missed you the other day. And then I just want to mention, Ms. Orr, I have about three or four of them, so I'm going to ask you to come back another time. But okay. Representative Portas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your testimony, you've revealed some very interesting numbers, and that the program has been going for 40 years and $750 million expended, and another couple hundred million in other areas. I don't know if the information exists, and if it does, could you direct me where to go to, or could information be compiled? My question is this. I would be interested to know, over this 40 years and all the money that we've spent, to what percentage or how far are we saturated in the total housing market, the total shelter market in Minnesota, is subsidized housing or has been created through subsidy and home buyer programs versus those other Minnesotans who have had to obtain their housing in a normal market without assistance? You know, how do I get a grasp of how far we've saturated the market in 40 years with assisted housing?
Madam Chair, Representative Hertaus, I can give you a couple of answers to that. One is that with respect to first-time home, with respect to mortgages for home ownership, the agency is typically under 1% of the total mortgages that are provided in the state. Yeah. So it's an indication of how much money. I mean, there's a lot of money. It takes a lot of money to buy houses, and we are typically under 1%. Yeah. And that's been historically true. The other answer that I can give you off the top of my head is that we know that we have about 32,000 Section 8 properties in the state. We Section 8 units, not Section 8 properties. We know we have a similar number, slightly under, of public housing. Both those programs provide very affordable housing. Those were funded initially by the federal government. The agency typically, although not on average, and it does depend upon the year, will produce about 1,000 or 1,200 new units, help finance about 1,000 or 1,200 new units of affordable housing each year. We have in Minnesota 600,000 households who are housing cost burdened.
Who are housing what?
Housing cost burden, meaning they pay more than 30% of their income for their housing. So, I can't give you readily this is how many units we've done over 40 years. I can tell you that despite our best efforts, we still have 600,000 households who pay more than 30% of their income. And the vast majority of those are households with incomes under $50,000.
Thank you. Thank you very much. 40 years is a long time to talk about, but I will ask you to, I think we'll have you come back next Monday because there's a few more questions I know I didn't get to ask another. So thank you very much for that testimony. And the meeting, members, is adjourned. We'll be back here next Monday.